So our speaker this morning is Diane Sheldon, who's here, and she's a certified professional wetland scientist and state certified science teacher with over 28 years of field experience in the Pacific Northwest. And she was King County's first wetland planner, where she established King County's wetland regulation program. And she ran her own environmental consulting firm for over 16 years, providing technical services to public and private clients. Now she's one of the principals of OTEC Incorporated and manages the natural resources section of science for that company. Her professional experience is in conducting field analysis and impact assessments, designing compensatory remediation and habitat restoration projects, providing regulatory strategies for complex projects, coordinating with regulatory agencies, and providing expert witness testimony on complex environmental and regulatory issues. She's an accomplished educator and continues to teach through the University of Washington certificate program, as well as other various technical wetland delineation.
Seriously.
And the regulation of wetlands. So the timing is just right there.
Close enough.
Tell us about
my version of
unnatural location.
The unnatural location.
Okay. Unnatural location. Consequences of urbanizing watersheds on landscape processes and wetland function. So,
is this my? Good morning. My apologies.
I normally am on a 6:30 ferry and sitting downtown by 10 minutes to 8. So I caught a 6:30 ferry and thought I had plenty of time. So my apologies, big traffic jam on I-5.
Can you hear okay?
Can you hear me back?
All right.
Okay,
good.
Is that a good?
We can't get access to the microphone this morning, so.
That's all right. That's okay. I can easily project, and as soon as I get warmed up, I don't think we'll have a problem. I also used to study improv theater a long time ago. So I was considering, well, I only have a few minutes. What should I launch into rather than boring slides? And really, what I want you to understand at the end of this talk, and what I want to have you think about, is there's a lot of science that we know now about the natural environment. And how does that science get applied? And what are the politics and the policies of how science gets applied? How many of you in this room are in some degree program, either not yet completed or working on completion, that has something to do with natural sciences? How many of you in this program think you're going to work in the realm of law or policy? Good job. Excellent. I want you guys to date each other so that your children will go on and do what we need to have done. So before I even launch into this, I want you to know that in 1981, my first job in the Northwest was to do field work for King County, helping them to inventory their wetlands. We inventoried about 1,000 wetlands in what was then western one-third, give or take, of King County, thank you. And we were driving back one day. I was with one of the planners, and I said, so what are you going to do with all this information? He said, well, what do you mean? I said, well, we now have all this data on 1,000 wetlands in King County. Aren't you going to do something with that information? He said, well, like what? I said, well, like tell the development community what they can and can't do about wetlands, like where they can put their buildings and their streets and their housing and so forth. He said, well, we hadn't thought about it. I said, we talked about it some more. I ended up writing a grant to King County, which was sort of a bizarre thing to do. I wrote a grant to King County. They hired me 8 months later to come back and draft their critical areas ordinance regulations for wetlands, to basically write the first management guidelines for wetlands for a local jurisdiction. It was the first time, I had no idea, first time it had been done in the United States. So we have things still in this state that sound like 25-foot setbacks from wetlands and 50-foot setbacks from wetlands. and 100-foot setbacks. At the time that those were drafted, in 1981, that was the best available science about how big those buffers and setbacks should be. So now we have a lot more science out there. And part of what I want to talk about is there's some new books that are just coming out, one in particular on urban herpetology. So amphibians, the whole realm of herps, and what's happening to them in the urban environment across the country. And there's three or four papers in this book that are here specifically written by colleagues in the Northwest. And what they're finding isn't surprising. But what the hard part is that we've actually known this information for a bunch of years, and we haven't been able to get it implemented yet as policy or regulation. So part of what I'm going to be talking about this morning is probably not new news to you. If you've been reading the newspaper, you kind of know what has happened as you get urbanization happening in watersheds. We've had a little bit of flooding. And not all of that is just because of the volume of rain that's falling out of the sky. So I'm going to run through these slides pretty quickly. If you're interested in any of this, a lot of the documentation is on the Washington State Department of Ecology's wetland web page. And Stephen Stanley has produced a document that is trying to help local jurisdictions do large-scale planning, incorporating science into the process, which is very innovative, to ask cities and counties to start doing land use planning based on environmental processes. And what he's looking at is these watershed scale processes that are affecting the landscape and analyzing those processes and identifying lands within a planning area that should be protected or set aside or allowed to be developed. Because the ones that are allowed to be developed are the ones that are most appropriate for the development and have the least environmental consequence if they're allowed to be developed. So he's using a watershed scale to look at processes that occur across the entire landscape. In this setting, I am not allowed to do this without being rude to you. And one of the things that he has identified is water, not surprisingly, is one of the largest forces out there at a landscape scale. And he's looking at how water moves nutrients, sediments, large woody debris, toxics, through a watershed system. And I don't know if you can read this from the back. You can probably hear me, but can you read this from the back? You can, okay. A little quiet, Bobby, yes, there's no vocalization back there. You guys have had plenty of time to talk. The text is a little small. But can you read most of it? Okay. So what this is color-coded to say is that in a watershed scale, how water gets into this watershed scale, not surprisingly, is through precipitation. How water moves at a watershed scale is it collects in surface storage, it falls down as precip, either as rainfall, snow melt, and once it's on the ground, it could be groundwater. It moves in these actions in blue, which is it can infiltrate into the shallow groundwater. And in this kind of language, when we say shallow groundwater, we're generally talking things that are less than 5 to 10 feet deep. When we're talking deep groundwater, that's what you use a well to pump up out of the ground, that's generally looked at as more than 20 feet deep. So he's talking that it can percolate or infiltrate into the shallow sub-groundwater. And notice that this shallow groundwater here has a movement. It has a flow within a watershed. That water can also recharge deeper groundwater, which also has a flow. It also moves. Water that comes into this into the soil can also go out. It can be stored or it can be discharged. It can be discharged into a stream. It can be discharged into springs. It can be discharged as being pumped out and put onto a field as irrigation, and that is discharge of that water as well. So it's pulled around the system. Here are the natural controls over how water moves through the system. The precipitation itself, what the vegetation is like in the watershed, what the surface soil, so again, in terminology, soils means that layer of frosting on the surface. The geologic setting is the deeper material below that, and then the topography itself. How we lose water out of a watershed is it moves downstream through stream flow. It can flow out of the basin. Does that make any sense? Flows out of the basin into Puget Sound, into the Columbia, into some larger receiving body. So it can move out of the watershed by flowing into a larger watershed or a larger basin. And over here, we can lose it through actions of evaporation off of the surface or transpiration, which is the action of plants pulling it up out of the ground and pumping it into the air. So in a big scale, that's how water moves around in a watershed. I'll try this one quickly. This is supposed to show how we, in our activities, start influencing that big watershed scale. So down here at the bottom, we can pull water out of either deep or shallow. I would show this arrow coming out of shallow as well. We can pull water out and use it for domestic use or irrigation, agriculture. We can affect discharge, but we can drain these wetland areas that this would have discharged into, and now there's no longer a place for those shallow waters to discharge. They may be piped away. You may have drain tiles in an ag field. That ag field used to be a wetland. Now we're pulling the water off the field very quickly through pipes. So we may disrupt that discharge pattern. We may move water faster or push it around by channelizing streams or ditching streams. We can disconnect. This is a frequent thing that we have done in the past. And I think the bad, there we go, is disconnecting streams from their floodplains. We fill the floodplains. How many of you have looked at the photographs of the flooding 2 weeks ago down at Chehalis River? Yep. Anybody see big box stores standing high and dry, surrounded by brown, muddy water? Okay, they filled the floodplain. And they put all their new development on top of that filled floodplain, and the flood of the river goes around it. So we've removed the stream, or the river in that case, from its floodplain. We've taken the floodplain away and ironically pushed the floodplain someplace else so that more people, or different people, are flooding than they used to. So these are all methods by which humans can affect at a watershed scale how water moves through here. And it is these movements or this process in a natural state that allows wetlands and other aquatic resources to form in a watershed. If we're not there, if human beings aren't affecting it, those landscape-scale processes are what put wetlands on the maps, put streams on the maps, floodplains and everything else. It's a huge scale that we're looking at. Never before in Washington State has anybody been asked to start planning land use considering these factors at such a large scale. What kind of factors are used for considering land use now? You didn't know I was going to ask you questions. They all just sat up a little tight. What kind of factors are used today for determining where certain land uses go, where apartments go versus where Kmarts go? Land use zoning. What influences land use zoning? You.
Politics.
Politics. Money. In the old days, land use zoning was driven by things like waterways. Think of every major metropolitan area in the United States of America. They're all located on rivers. Not because people like riparian areas, but because that's where the commerce was. That's where the ships were. That's where the industry was. That's how you got goods to and from. That zoning of industrial use adjacent to those waterways and the housing then got built up behind it was because of a natural process of using these watershed processes to do commerce around the country. Railroads came, shifted that a bit, but not very much because the railroad hubs oftentimes tied into those historic port hubs because that's the framework that we had already established. So the wetlands end up being established and maintained by landscape processes. Sometimes not huge watershed scales, sometimes much smaller basin scale processes. But they're very similar. And in particular, the processes that drive these wetlands, not surprising, is water. How often is it there? What's the timing of the water getting there? What's the frequency during a year? So a water year, which is October 1 to October 1, is a water year in the Northwest. And how long is the water there? What are the underlying soils like? What is the geology, the superficial geology in the basin? And these physical parameters drive the vegetation communities that get established. Does that make sense? Same kind of things we heard at a big scale, now they're just at a smaller scale. Okay, so presence and duration of water is a key driver. There'll be a quiz on this part. This is the only formula you're going to have to memorize for the test that I'm sure you're going to have next week. This is basically a water budget. It's a water budget. Now, you could think of this as your bathtub, or you can think of this as a wetland. Water can only get into this wetland through groundwater moving in laterally, a surface water flow, precipitation. Surface water flow may be an open water conveyance like a stream, or in really heavy rainstorms like last week and 2 weeks ago, we had surface water that was flowing across the surface of upland soils because the soils were saturated. That's how water gets in. Precip, surface water, groundwater. How water gets out, it sneaks out through the groundwater. Now that can go down as well as laterally. You may have a surface water outlet, and then you have evapotranspiration. The difference between the sum of the precip, surface water, and groundwater in, the evapotranspiration, surface water, and groundwater out, the difference is the storage. In a water year in the Northwest, this system might be completely dry in November. And the rains start in and nothing will come out until we've completely charged this system. That volume that gets held in there, that's the storage that's represented in this water budget formula. So when we think about wetlands from an engineering standpoint, we have to think about a mathematical budget of how much water comes in and how much water goes out, where the water gets stored, because I want you to imagine this in the middle of a 5,000-acre forest. It's pretty easy to visualize how that would all work. Now, cut down the forest and make this surrounded by Capitol Hill or the University District or Wallingford or, you know, make it Green Lake. And imagine what the basin of Green Lake looks like, the contributing area to Green Lake. Green Lake used to be a very lovely wetland, pre-us. And it had the same water budget. It has the same water budget today. It's just that some of these variables have changed dramatically over the course of changes in the landscape. This is just a really quick review.
None of you seem to be dozing yet. I think asking you a few questions made you sit up, just like, ooh, she's going to get me. I know she is. So here's another key word, which is hydroperiod. Hydroperiod is the pattern of the water, its depth, its duration, and the pattern over the course of a water year for a wetland. The hydroperiod is not a one-day event or a flood event. It's how does that wetland get water? How does it respond to that water budget over the course of a water year? That's what the hydroperiod is. What do you imagine happens to a wetland's hydroperiod if it becomes Green Lake? He was brave enough to make eye contact. Anybody? Ooh, they're all looking down. What happens? Somebody volunteer. What happens to that hydroperiod to Green Lake when it was in a natural condition and now it's in a completely built-up condition? Somebody give me a postulation. What changes? Yes, good job.
Flows of water produce more spiky because it's not absorbed in the ground, it's just running off.
Excellent. Let me ask you the trick question. Just set aside for a second the question of global warming and climate change. Is any more water falling out of the sky?
No.
It's not. Okay. We assume that the storm patterns and the rainfall patterns are the same. He's absolutely correct. When the rainfall falls on impervious surfaces, pavement, roads, roofs, your lawn acts like an impervious surface. All that water is collected in our storm drain system, collected into pipes. It's the same volume of water, theoretically, that used to fall when it was forested. But now it's collected off these hard surfaces into hard pipes. So there's a large volume of water that moves towards Green Lake very quickly. So the speed of it getting to the wetland is much faster. And that influences that hydroperiod. Yes? I think our flooding occurred with different patterns in the past. He asked, I'm sorry, if we've seen more flooding now than we used to in the past. One of the things we see more of now is we see more 100-year storms. I have seen at least 5 100-year storms in the last 10 years. Think about the mathematics of that, everybody. 100-year storms are those storms that are supposed to have a probability of occurring once every 100 years. So we're having the effect of climate change as part of that postulation. But also, we have clear-cut a lot of these watersheds. So the effect of what happens when a volume of water falls out of the sky is very different than it used to be. The Chehalis example is a good example of, the county, Chehalis County, wanted the tax revenue from all that commercial industrial land use down in the floodplain. Let's be really candid. That's what they wanted. They wanted the tax revenue from it. So FEMA had not accurately mapped the floodplains down there. So the county went ahead and allowed those lands to be built by making the developers build up on high pads that just happened to be higher than the calculated 100-year floodplain that FEMA would have used had they mapped it correctly. But what that does is push the floodplain of the Chehalis around, and it affects other things. So we're seeing more effects from the rainfall than we used to. Good question. Okay, now, we think of, and I'm running through this really quickly, we think about the functions that are associated with wetlands, and really quickly, the three quickest to talk about, wetlands have the ability to improve or to change water quality, they can affect water quantity within their basin, and they can provide wildlife habitat. The functions for water quality are things like how deep is the water in the wetland and how long does the water stay there?
Why does that influence water quality?
Friend with the dark beard. I'm sorry, I can't repeat the question.
Why does a depth and duration of water in this wetland affect water quality? Yeah. It improves it. How come?
The depth improves water quality.
It improves the water quality. Depth and the duration of the water in the pond improves water quality. Why? Yes.
More filtration.
Good idea, but use a different word.
Settlement.
More settlement. The next thing you'll get to answer is filtration. So she said more filtration. No, the first thing is you put a gunky, dirty, filthy water into a deep pool and you let it sit. What happens to the dirt particles? Fall out. So just having that long retention pond. If you've heard about a retention pond or a detention pond, they are detaining the water, partly for a quantity help, which we'll talk about in a second, but also it affects water quality because it allows that silt and sediment to fall out into the stormwater pond. If you have a wetland that's fully vegetated, then you get that great aspect of filtration. Anybody here drink coffee? Only six people? Okay. So when you make your own coffee at home, says the woman who's sipping that little white cup and probably didn't raise her hand, how many times do you use your coffee filter before you change it? Usually once, right? Do we think our wetlands have an infinite capacity to filter out dirt and silt and sediment that's coming through them? No. Just like a coffee filter, they don't. They don't have that capacity. At a certain point, the wetland could silt in. At a certain point, if they're getting a lot of excess nutrients, heavy metals, and toxics, those materials may be taken up into the plant tissues that are in the wetland. But here in the Northwest, all of our herbaceous plants in our wetlands die every fall. And what happens to the heavy metals and the toxics that aren't broken down by the plants is they can actually be either released down into the sediments or released down into a flush downstream out of the wetland. So these wetlands are not long-term solutions to dirty water, but they do have the opportunity to improve water quality. Water quantity is this, you know, that's a really obvious one. If you have a basin and you have a restricted opening on the outlet end of it, and you pour water into it, you can back water up into this wetland area, right? As long as the outlet is narrow and tiny compared to the inlet. It's called having a restricted outlet or a restricted orifice. You may have friends who have restricted orifices. I don't want to know about that. Okay? But in order for a wetland to be able to provide storage, it's got to have that restricted orifice and it has to have sides. Right? Because if it's a really flat wetland, if you pump a whole bunch of water into it, water flows into it, it's just going to flow out over the sides, just like your coffee cup, if you don't pay attention and you're filling it up. So it's got to have the ability to stack water up inside of it. You've got to have a basin there. That makes sense? And in order for this to work effectively, the outlet of this wetland or the basin has to be down below the rim of the basin. So that water comes in, it fills up the basin while water's shooting out the outlet, and then after the storm event stops, the water level keeps trickling back out until it reaches that outlet elevation. Now that could be a beaver dam, it can just be a narrow constriction on a natural wetland, or if a civil engineer does it, it's called a stormwater pump. Same concept. That's how wetlands help control surface water. They also sometimes allow water to recharge into the shallow groundwater so that they recharge streams. They leak that water out to streams,
later in the year after the rains have stopped. So that's one of the key functions that wetlands provide here in the Northwest on both sides of the mountains, is they hold water in storage like a giant sponge. And May, June, July, when the rains have all tapered, the soils in the wetlands can still eat that water out to those streams and keep the aquatic insects in those streams alive longer.
It's a really key function in these watershed processes.
You have 7 minutes.
I have 7 minutes. And I probably have 30 slides, so we'll just go through these quickly.
So wildlife habitat is really what I'm going to focus on the most, because that's the coolest thing and might keep your interest a little bit longer. For 7 minutes, you only have 7 minutes. You can do this for 7 minutes. Hydroperiod affects habitat, again, around the timing and duration question. Habitat's also driven by the vegetation that's established in this wetland and physical complexity. And the really key thing is it's not a wetland in isolation. This is what our data is now telling us. Klaus Richter, PhD's, I think he's had his doctorate get picked up. Phenomenal ecologist, is part of this publishing group that's coming in this new Hurt book. And what he's finding is that these fixed buffers that we have on our wetlands of 25 feet, 50 feet, 100 feet, are not enough to keep our amphibian populations viable. Because we forget that amphibians only use these wetlands for a very short period of their time, of their lifetime, and that is to reproduce. The rest of their lifetime, they're out partying in the uplands. And if there's no uplands, they're screwed. And that's what's happening as this is one of the key things that we're trying to figure out here in doing these watershed planning scales, is how do you keep these pockets of habitat linked to each other so that we have effective habitat across a landscape, so that these populations can commingle their DNA, which is what we know that they're supposed to be doing over time. So we can't just leave these wetlands sitting in isolation. We've got to make sure that they're connected to each other. And I'm just going to flip through some of these and let you read while I talk about it. So here are some interesting things that happens, and these are a little blurry, and I apologize for them. The changes, can you even read these? The illustration is trying to show you here, in a pre-development state, 35% of the rainfall soaks into the soil, 15% flows off as surface water, and a much larger percent in a forested condition goes off into the air as evapotranspiration. And this is trying to show you that soil is a living organism in a natural condition. It's full of holes, it's full of airways from beetles and bugs and mammals and all sorts of things. So it lets the water flow in, which is why we have this huge percentage of water that flows in rather than off in a natural condition. And in a built condition, look at the size of the arrows. They change. 15% either gets detained or it might infiltrate. 55.7% flows off as surface water because we've changed the soil, it can't get in. Or we have all this imperviousness and there's no way for it to go. We've lost most of our vegetation pumps, so our evapotranspiration drops down to 15%. So the built environment strongly influences what happens. And gosh, when you start having development, you put sediment in movement. They're supposed to collect this sediment into these stormwater ponds. So this is the stormwater pond, deep, long duration, except it sort of leaked at the bottom of the gravel. So this is a beautiful, formerly beautiful, Queen's Bog up in the Klahani development, just east of Sammamish. And this is stormwater runoff flowing off into Lake Sammamish during a typical storm event from development activities where we don't have appropriate erosion control. So these are those watershed and landscape shale processes that are going on. Ooh, that didn't come through at all. This is downtown Bellevue, 1937.
This is it in 1996. Little bit of a change. Okay, you can imagine how water was different then. But even here, that's all ag land. Bellevue used to be a truck farmer's location, and they would boat it across Lake Washington and sell it at Pike Place Market. So Bellevue used to have all these great ag lands, and guess what? A lot of these soils were actually wetland soils. Today, it kind of looks a little different. Okay, a little bit more imperviousness, a little bit flashier runoff. Trick question, the water that's collected in Bellevue's stormwater system, where is it most of it discharged? Lake Washington. Good job. So, 60-year transition. We've lost the open space. EIA is the effective impervious area. We've lost that. We've had a huge change in hydro period. He looks a lot bigger up there than he does over here. Here's one of the big things that happens, that change in the hydro period. When we collect water off of hard surfaces and direct it towards these natural systems, they get wetter faster in the fall, and they dry out more quickly in the spring. Because we're throwing water at them in pipes, and there's no water left in the soil to recharge the wetlands in the spring. These guys, Pacific tree frogs, lay their egg masses in these wetlands, and what's happening in some of our wetlands is they're drying out so quickly that the egg masses are being exposed and they're not viable. So we've changed the hydro period in these wetlands in some instances, and it's starting to affect the life history. We also have water level fluctuations going on from storm events that I don't have time to go into. The changes in the hydro period here, these frog eggs are, or they're salamander actually, I think, are attached to thin-stemmed vegetation. If the water level changes in that wetland after the frog lays her eggs on that stem, the eggs are not viable. I'll take that cue. And the cue that people are walking out to go to another class.
Okay. So we're going to talk about one question.
Take your science and apply it. Questions, even as you're walking out. Yes. Loud.
Given that most of all the developed areas,
Go plant trees. Seriously, plant trees, volunteer to plant trees. Yeah, there's always tree planting events that are going on. Go plant trees. It's a good thing to do.